I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with John Wiener, Emeritus Professor of U.S. History at UC Irvine, host and producer of Start Making Sense, the Nation's magazine's weekly podcast, and author with Mike Davis of Set the Night on Fire, LA in the 60s. And you can learn more at johnwiener.com, and that's J-O-N, no H, J-O-N, Wiener, W-I-E-N-E-R. JONWIENER.com. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. There are, only several weeks now until what has long been called Election Day. But if you're thinking of voting by mail, with the post office now led by a Trump crony and hit hard by the loss of business mail, I think we'd be wise to give ourselves at least a two-week margin. So vote by mail and consider Election Day October 20th. I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote, all the more challenging in this pandemic time. As we confront the pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask, and finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation that's now unfolding. And finally, as we continue to make our voices heard against racism and police brutality and for justice and inclusion, please do your part to keep this campaign alive, whether it's showing up on the streets or helping with organizing or fundraising, or just taking on the deep reflection or habit building in your personal life and with those closest to you. Now to today's guest. I believe John Wiener and I have known each other for about 25 years since I started doing this show on KPFK in 1996. What I didn't know until preparing for this interview was that our time in Cambridge at Harvard overlapped. I was an undergrad from 65 to 69, while John was pursuing his PhD. And here, I'm going to go out on the sturdiest of limbs. I'm pretty sure that our paths crossed in April 1969, that we were both in University Hall when the Massachusetts State Troopers showed up at dawn. The building had been taken over the afternoon before by a few members of SDS and later occupied by hundreds of students, including myself, with a set of demands that included an African-American studies department and kicking ROTC, R-O-T-C, off of campus. Let me quickly ask, am I right, John? Were we both in that building at that moment?
At that moment, I was outside, and one of my assignment from Mike and Sarah was with my little group. We were supposed to try to open the doors of the vans that had the kids who were going to be arrested and liberate them. Needless to say, this was a suicide mission. One of my cohorts got clubbed in the kneecap by a Somerville cop, I think it was, and was on crutches for the next couple of months. We failed at our assignment. Did you get arrested?
No, my story is just so, it's sort of when I, you know, we all have our 60 stories. So mine is that I had been off campus when the building was taken over. I actually started an alternative high school that year, and I was out there teaching. And I came back to campus, saw what had happened, went in, and when the troopers were about to come in, there are two entrances, as you recall, to University Hall. And they had a battering ram, and there were the doors were chained shut. And they were coming in one of the stairways, one of the doorways, which if they had come in that one, I was in the very front row. And there was a picture that ran in one of the Harvard publications. And believe me, I was scared. And what happened was they couldn't get that door to give. So they went to the other door with their battering ram, bashed it in, came in, didn't say anything like raise your hands, march out, you're under arrest, anything. They just came in swinging, long billy clubs. I looked back at now what was as far from me as possible, and jumped out of a window. And those wow. The windows were high enough that the worst injury of that scene was a woman who also jumped out of the window and broke her back.
Oh.
So that was so it turns out we were not in the same building. We were in the same event. So, and I point this out as a fitting intro to our conversation on John's new book, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. It's co-written with Mike Davis, author of a number of books. I've interviewed him a number of times. And his books include the excellent and evocative City of Quartz, which I highly recommend if you haven't read it. It's a kind of a unique historical perspective on Los Angeles and Southern California. Now, L.A. in the 60s. I spent maybe 1 week of the 60s in L.A. I was driving around the country the summer of 1969 with my girlfriend in her VW van. No kidding. I know we're a cliche. She left the road for a couple of weeks to visit her family, so I arrived in L.A. alone, got off the 405, the new 405, and drove into Westwood. My first vision of this city is two long lines waiting to attend midnight showings of Easy Rider and Midnight Cowboy.
Wow.
Across the street from each other at the Fox and the Bruin Theaters.
Fabulous.
And I would spend that night sleeping in that van in a gas station somewhere quite near that intersection. And that is part of the story that John and Mike tell. But more than the counterculture, they focus on Los Angeles as an epicenter of political and social uprising, a side of the city's history that seldom gets its due. I have been thinking a lot about the 60s lately. I see parallels and contrasts and imagine something I call 60s 2.0. Millennials and younger pursuing many of the values and visions of the best of the 60s, but equipped with technological, demographic, and cultural advantages that I believe offer a better chance to achieve a deeper and more sustainable change this time around. And I plan to talk about that with John as well. John Wehner, an emeritus professor of U.S. history at UC Irvine, is host and producer of Start Making Sense, the Nation Magazine's weekly podcast. He hosts a weekly interview show on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. He sued the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act for its files on John Lennon, and Wehner versus FBI went all the way to Supreme Court before the FBI settled in 1997. And that story is told in his book, Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files. Since 1984, he's been a contributing editor for The Nation, and some of his other books include How We Forgot the Cold War, Conspiracy in the Streets, The Extraordinary Trial of the Chicago 8, and his latest, co-authored with Mike Davis, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. Welcome, John Wehner, to Freeform, a world that just might work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, September 11th.
Thank you very much, Terry. I always thought you were a lot younger than me. I'm shocked to find out that you're not. You're a little younger than me, not a lot younger than
right.
me.
Right. Now,
I always thought of you as kind of a teenager.
Oh, thank you. That's funny. But I what's funny is on the other side of it, I always thought of us as the same age. And was surprised that you when I looked, you know, up your bio and saw that, you know, that you were those few years older. But thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So briefly, how do you see your path to the work you do these days? You can go way back. And obviously, this whole book suggests going way back. Mentors, yeah, turning so. Points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, my 60s began really when I was in high school. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and I went to Central High. Minnesota was the land of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, a liberal side of the Democrats of the 50s and 60s. So I grew up in the world of Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy and Walter Mondale. These were, you know, these were Minnesota's gifts to the Democratic Party. And I did join my first picket line in 1960. There was a support picket line for the sit-in movement, which was in the Deep South, run by SNCC in the winter and early spring of 1960. They were sitting in at segregated lunch counters, especially at Woolworths. And so there was a national movement to picket Woolworths across the country. And I went downtown St. Paul. There was a Woolworths, and joined with a friend of mine, and joined a picket line of very sober and well-dressed black adults. And I kind of always wanted to be a movement person. And my idea, I had, you know, read about the Bay Area and the HUAC demonstrations there and anti-HUAC demonstrations in San Francisco. My idea was you go to college and become a movement activist. And for some reason, I still don't understand. I was recruited from Central High School in St. Paul to go to Princeton. Mm-hmm. They gave three of us big scholarships. Apparently, they had already decided they wanted Princeton to be more than you know, rich alumni sons of mostly Southern types.
By the way, let me cut in for a second because
sure.
Harvard, in a way, did the same sort of thing. I was a poor white kid from Florida, Catholic. You know, I mean, I was enough in the demographic that I think that helped me. And what has been, I think, pretty reliably chronicled is that the Ivy League schools saw the error of their ways around 1969 yeah. and went back to much more conservative recruitment in the early 70s.
Yeah. And did you go to public school or parochial school?
It was interesting. I went to Catholic school from first grade through 10th grade, and that was all in the state of Florida. And my family moved to Cocoa, Brevard County, around the space program before my junior year, and there was no Catholic high school. So in 11th and 12th grade, I went to Cocoa High, public high school, and for the first time actually had girls in the same classroom.
Wow. A great day, I'm sure.
It was.
In your life. I arrived at Princeton in the fall of 1963, and the very first thing that happened, like a month after classes began, was the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a group of left-wing, mostly grad students, faculty, and townspeople who had a little picket line downtown Princeton. And so I carried a sign that said, "Blockade is an act of war." You know, we were against a nuclear war over missiles in Korea. And my idea had been you go to college to become an activist. And within a month, I was already an activist,
even though it was
Princeton. And then, you know, eventually we organized an SDS chapter. Mm-hmm. Tom Hayden was just up the road in Newark, organizing white people to, you know, into community activist groups. And then the last thing that happened in my Princeton years, in 1966, Lyndon Johnson came to the Princeton campus to dedicate the new Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Princeton has just taken his name off of that building.
I didn't know if they'd done it, but I knew it was in the news because Wilson was a famous racist.
Yes, introduced segregation in government federal government employment. Anyway, this was the Vietnam War was going strong, May of 1966, and our last event at Princeton was a big picket line protesting Johnson's presence on campus and the war. So that was very nice bookends. And then I arrived in Cambridge and Harvard in 1967, and the very first thing that happened there was that Robert McNamara yeah. came to the campus and refused to meet. To have any public events, and so SDS, hundreds, I think 800 people, something like that, surrounded his car, trapped him, and demanded that he, you know, speak to us so that we could let him know our opposition to the war. So that was my introduction to life at Harvard.
Let me cut in one other time.
Please.
We were lucky in that period, besides the students. Boston and Cambridge is a center of colleges. I think at that point there were 32. There's more than that now. But we had Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn at BU and Noam Chomsky at MIT as sort of these figures I remember at the demonstrations I would go to.
Wow. I don't remember that, but I'm sure You're right. I mean, they were huge presences. This was when Chomsky was writing for started writing for the New York Review about the obligations of the intellectual. You know, now it seems a little pretentious, but at the time it was, you know, considered a very huge huge thing. Anyway, then of course, SDS, you were there. A year-long campaign to push ROTC off campus, and you know, if they weren't going to do it, we were going to have a student strike because Columbia had showed how to do it. And that's exactly what happened, and we hadn't quite anticipated what a big issue Black Studies would be, but that was added as the, what, eighth demand or something like
And
that.
there were other demands that were you know, were less national in scope, which was just that Harvard be a decent landlord and a decent neighbor to
Yes.
the surrounding citizens.
And the second center of my political activism in Cambridge after SDS was the Old Mole, one of the more political underground papers of the country. I loved working on the Old Mole, and the Old Mole, those were the days when, you know, you could publish a newspaper, the record companies would buy full page ads, so it would all be paid for, and you know, we distributed thousands of copies. And then when the strike came, we put out a Old Mole strike daily,
Oh,
and
yeah.
that was kind of my introduction to political journalism. And I decided what I wanted to do was to be a kind of activist and journalist. And my then girlfriend, who was a grad student in the history department, got a job at UCLA. So I came out to LA with her right behind you, it sounds like, in August of 1969. We got a little place in Santa Monica. She was going to start teaching at UCLA. There was one another new hire at UCLA in the philosophy department. Hired a young woman who had been working with Herbert Marcuse, who none of us knew anything about. Her name was Angela Davis. And she was going to start at the same time. And just before classes began, we've now been in LA for 4 weeks. Angela Davis gets outed as a member of the Communist Party by an undercover agent who wrote a letter to the Daily Bruin. And right away, the whole campus is embroiled in this battle to the Regents can't fire an assistant professor because of her political views. The 50s were over. McCarthyism had been defeated. So there was lots to write about. Now I wrote for Liberation News Service, which was the kind of, I don't know, wire service of the underground press. They sent out packets to, I don't know, 300 underground newspapers all over the country. And shortly after that, there was a very active right-wing Cuban militant, actually quite violent terrorist group in Los Angeles that was setting fire to SWPE offices and to other movement centers. And I interviewed for one of my very first articles from Los Angeles, the targets of one of the arson attacks was a movement center down by MacArthur Park, firebombed. And the guy I interviewed was Mike Davis, who was a kind of a famous local organizer. So this is my introduction to Los Angeles, Angela Davis and Mike Davis, unrelated, I guess I
So a
should
couple
say.
of things I hear there. One, you seem to show up and trouble starts.
Just lucky. Just lucky, I
That's right.
guess.
That's right. Good trouble, as John Lewis would say.
Yeah.
And that I love that sort of bookend that you meet Mike Davis, young organizer at that point, and you don't become friends until years later. The third thing I was going to say was just how the activism, you know, seems to be. I mean, when you describe like that LNS is distributing packets to 300 alternative newspapers, of course now there's way more than 300, you know, alternative websites, but 300 alternative newspapers is it's a testament to something alive in the country.
You bet. Every place, and some of them were quite famous. And thank God, some left-wing librarians collected all of them, and they're all on microfilm at big libraries like UCLA. But, you know, the great speckled bird in Atlanta was quite famous. The East Village Other, yeah. The, you know, San Francisco, what was the one in the of course, there was the, you know, Berkeley, the Bay Area had two or three. And a lot of them were just published, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Dr. Hippocrates, the.
Yeah. Yeah.
The drug advice column. Others had a very strong political
Keep on Truckin', R. Crumb Comics, and Mr. Natural.
Yes. Yes. Eventually it became, you know, this. Let's put it this way. The 60s came to an end.
Yes.
That's a sad story. And I finished my PhD thesis for the Harvard Government Department, and then got a job in the history department at UC Irvine, started teaching there in 73 and 74.
How old was UC Irvine at the time?
It had been founded, the groundbreaking for UC Irvine, this is California in the 60s. It's Clark Kerr, the president of the University of California, who was in favor of the multiversity, and LBJ in something like 1965 are breaking ground for the new campus. I think they may have opened in 67 or something like that. They were in the middle of in a cow pasture in the middle of nowhere. But that was when public education and public higher education, the University of California, was growing leaps and bounds. They're opening three new university campuses. I think to go to UC cost something like $40 a quarter or something like that. This was a golden age for public education in America, and especially in California.
Yes. If you look back at what made California, California, there were many things, but one of them was that they led the way in public education. And as knowledge workers and all of that became more important, California had a head start. Although, as you point out, the public schools were not so lucky, and so people of color we're not getting that same benefit of all that wonderful, very affordable education.
And that takes us to Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. The image of California, and especially Southern California and Los Angeles in the 60s, the image that kids all over America and all over the world had was the beach, surf culture, the Beach Boys, Gidget.
Yep.
77 Sunset Strip, Surfer Girl, and adults knew that there was an economic boom around the aerospace industry in Southern California, and you could get your own little house in a little suburb and make a decent living and send your kids to school. The starting point of our book is to point out that for millions of young people of color in Southern California, this dream did not exist. We say the working class heroes of our book are the young people of the great flatlands of Los Angeles and Southern California, who went to lousy schools, who couldn't segregated schools. These are Black and Latino kids for the most part. The concept of Chicano did not yet exist. They were shut out of decent housing and by strict residential segregation. Some of the strictest residential segregation anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, unlike where I was going to high school.
The aerospace industry.
Sorry, excuse me. Unlike where I was going to high school in Florida, where they were strictly segregated, and there were Black schools and white schools, both of the high schools that I went to, the one in Jacksonville my first 2 years, and the one Coco my last 2 years, were integrated while I was there with, eight Black students entering the schools. Here, it was because of the real estate covenants, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Los Angeles real estate was rigorously banned Blacks from all the new suburban developments. And that was one of the early foci of activism in Los Angeles. There's kind of a forgotten period that we document carefully in the opening chapters of our book. From like 60 to 64, there is a nonviolent direct action movement in Los Angeles, inspired by the South, by CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They are challenging the racially segregated new suburbs and developments, especially in Torrance. Torrance was completely white, was sort of the promise of Torrance, live with white people. What could be better? And there were picket lines when new subdivisions opened. There were sit-ins at the what do they call them? You know, the sample houses that you could visit.
Oh, the model homes.
The model homes. There were mass arrests. And there was also a big campaign to integrate the schools of Los Angeles. The ACLU and the NAACP had filed suit. LA, inspired by the South, had quite a substantial and quite a integrated, direct, nonviolent, direct action campaign that sought integration. 1965 is kind of the turning point for all of this. That's August 1965 is the Watts Rebellion. Completely shocked the mainstream media. The conventional wisdom was that in national politics, LBJ had signed the Voting Rights Act at the beginning of August 1965. We wish we had the Voting Rights Act today.
Exactly.
We miss it. It was the most far-reaching civil rights reform really since the end of the Civil War that enlisted the federal government in making sure that blacks could vote everywhere in America, especially in the South where they'd been barred and banned. Just a week after that was when Watts exploded 5 days of violence. The National Guard was called in. In the end, 34 people had been killed. And everybody said, what have we missed? This was supposed to be, the blacks had won.
The civil rights movement has, right. It set out and it achieved its goals. Yeah.
Exactly. So what's going on? What did we miss? What went wrong in LA? Well, what went wrong was that in 1964, there had been a statewide referendum on what was then called open housing. The state legislature after massive organizing and political protest and pressure on the state legislature had passed a kind of weak open housing law prohibiting racial discrimination in certain kinds of apartment houses. That was put on up on there was a referendum to repeal open housing in California on the ballot in 1964. It passed overwhelmingly. Two-thirds of white people in California voted to end the brief experiment in open housing in Los Angeles. And that brought an end to this nonviolent direct action campaign. And the Watts riots followed several months later, triggered by an incident, a fairly small traffic mm-hmm. stop by the highway patrol that the LAPD got involved with. And that brings us to the LAPD. I think you've heard of them.
Yes, I the way that I was phrasing it was, it's a primary character in your book, as close as anything to the villain.
Yeah, it's of course, the LAPD saw its primary job as kind of enforcing racial subordination, and they devoted themselves to that with great gusto and energy, and many outrageous events that were not documented for the white media. But there still are. There's a black community newspaper presence in America going back, 100 years, 150 years. The LA Sentinel, the California Eagle, regularly documented outrages perpetrated by the LAPD against black people. And this exploded in August of 1965. The striking thing to me, I didn't quite realize, of course, the LAPD was also had years of experience fighting what they regarded as Reds, the mm-hmm. Red Squad, mm-hmm. Kind of a legacy of McCarthyism that was alive and well in the LAPD, and they saw the new left, the campus anti-war movement and the civil rights movement as communists in the streets, and it was their job to stop them. So there was also a lot of antagonism between the movement in the LAPD, but the LAPD was also basically, let me just say, our book, the kind of the backbone, the spine of our book is the organizing and struggles of Black and Latino LA. And then that's kind of the central story of the movement in Southern California.
By the way, John, let me say that you call your book a movement history, right?
Yes. There's a lot of things we don't deal with. We don't deal with movies. We don't deal with popular music, except when it has political significance. Mm-hmm. This is a movement history. And of course, there's a lot of other movements kind of inspired by and following the example in many cases of the first the civil rights movement and then the Black Power movements. There's, of course, there's the anti-war movement. There's the women's liberation movement. There's the gay liberation movement. It's very important origins in Los Angeles. There is a Asian American movement appears at the very end of this period. And then there's the counterculture that supports and speaks for and helps organize this movement. There's KPFK is a very important part of this story. The LA Free Press, yep. America's largest underground newspaper, which eventually had 250,000 readers. The LA Free Clinic, which kind of originated the concept that healthcare is a human right. So all that is part of this story that kind of centers around Black struggle. And the most striking thing about the LAPD and all this is the LAPD was against all of it.
That's right. That's right. Let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with John Wiener. He's Emeritus Professor of U.S. History at UC Irvine, host and producer of Start Making Sense, the Nation Magazine's weekly podcast. Also has a weekly interview show on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and the author with Mike Davis of the book and the events we're talking about now. The book is Set the Night on Fire, LA in the 60s, and you can learn more at johnwiener.com. That's JONWIENER.com. One thing that you point out when you say the police, I'm going to quote you here, no other major city outside of the Deep South was subjected to such a fanatic and all-encompassing campaign to police space and control the night. They just wanted to control the city.
You know, part of, Mike Davis, among his many other, is known as an urban theorist. And the contest over public space is an important part of the story that we tell. Not just the streets of Watts, not just the streets of East LA, but there's central struggles centered around Sunset Strip and Venice Beach that involve white youth. There's the famous Sunset Strip riots commemorated in song and film. There's something happening here.
That's right. Most people think that For What It's Worth must be about anti-Vietnam protests, but it was young, many of them white kids who were fighting the curfew.
Yes, there was a, it's a kind of a, people who don't live here don't know about this, but counties are policed by a sheriff, an elected figure, with a separate department of deputy sheriffs. The city is policed by the LA Police Department, but not all of Los Angeles is part of the city of LA. And there's a, for strange reason, Sunset Strip was never incorporated into the city of LA, so it was patrolled by the sheriffs. Mm. East LA also. And then, of course, Santa Monica, Culver City, Long Beach have our independent cities with their own police departments. But the county established a curfew on Sunset Strip, and young people from all over Southern California would come to the Sunset Strip on weekend nights to fight the police. it was an important part of 1965 and 1966. We're very interested in this story because it shows just the kind of how deep the anti-authoritarianism of the 60s ran and how broadly it included young, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old white kids,
yeah,
from the valley, from farther out. And the other location of intense fighting between the police and the community was Venice. Mm-hmm. Venice had been a bohemian beatnik center in the 50s, jazz, poetry readings and coffee houses.
Expats. Yeah.
And of course, Venice Beach. A free space, if there ever was one, the Venice Boardwalk with its candles and sandals, and still there's still some of that exists on the Venice Boardwalk. Mm-hmm. But the police didn't like it, didn't like gatherings of young people on summer weekends. And I can remember in the late 60s and early 70s going to Venice Beach on Sunday, again, to fight the police. The police would say they'd had a complaint about the drum circles. These drum circles are usually black people, black men. And so the police would come to shut down the drum circle. This is like Sunday at 2 o'clock when there's thousands of people at Venice Beach. And the people would kind of object. Or the police would say, we've had complaints about nude bathing. Women took their bikini tops off on Venice Beach. You know, we're going to put a stop to this. So, you know, the LAPD Metro Squad wearing riot gear would try to sweep Venice Beach and people would fight back. And often these fights were huge and involved thousands of people. And Venice eventually launched a organized movement to secede from the city of LA and have their own independent city with their own police force that would support, you know, the people. That's one of my favorite chapters of the book, is the forgotten story of the Free Venice campaign.
Yeah. Let me tee up a couple of things that I want you just to comment on. One is, you referred to it, but I think most people do not know. I think most people think of New York as the center of gay activism, the birthplace of gay activism. So that's one strand I'd like you to mention. The other is the fact that communists actually still played a role. That's one of, and the third that I want you to spend some time on is that, unlike so many places where the big colleges, the students of the big colleges were the main troops of protest, here USC was Republican. UCLA had some, but the real leaders were from the state, the Cal State system or the City College and so on. I think you say Valley State, which is now Cal State Northridge, was the most active. So a little bit on gay, a little bit on communists, and then how youth and working class college kids were the leaders here.
Well, let me do it in chronological order. The Communist Party of Southern California was an important center for an organization of organizers. And that was mostly because of a single person, Dorothy Healy, who was the head of a very inspiring figure in Mike's life. I knew her and loved her, and thousands of other young people, black and white, did. This was a kind of independent-minded, they had a adversarial relationship with the National Communist Party going back to the 50s when they were reluctant to go underground. Dorothy Healy was very committed to the communists should be a public presence, and she ran for county tax assessor in 1964 and got something like 60,000 votes running as a communist.
Yeah.
She also had a radio program on KPFK called Communist Commentary at the very beginnings of KPFK. This was pretty unusual thing for any radio station in America, and led to a license challenge and a HUAC investigation of the Pacifica Foundation. One of the things Dorothy was most committed to was young organizing and teaching young activists. She's one of the people who recruited and became a mentor to Angela Davis. There was a non-white caucus called the Chela Mumba Caucus of the Communist Party that had some very important and talented and committed people. And Mike Davis was also a member of the Communist Party of Southern California and a protege of Dorothy Healy. So they were kind of, and of course, once Angela was outed, this became a huge issue, and Angela became, of course, the most famous radical of the 60s. And the Angela, once she was arrested and charged in a falsely with providing the guns for a shootout at the Marin County Courthouse, they were her guns, but it was not, she had never intended them and knew nothing about this and was found innocent. But the Angela Davis Defense Committee was like one of the biggest political organizations of the era. So that's, the Communist Party was central to a lot of things. One of the things the Communist Party did under Dorothy Healey, however, was they did follow the party line on expelling gay men. The idea was, well, they're vulnerable to being blackmailed by the FBI and to being informers. And there had been several very talented organizers who were gay, who were kicked out of the Communist Party, and they started organizing an independent, a separate gay movement in Los Angeles. One of the fruits of that was more than two years before Stonewall, LA had the first open street protest by gay people against police harassment of gay bars. We think of Stonewall as the beginning, but really it's the Black Cat Tavern in Silver Lake on Sunset Boulevard was the first place that gay people stood up to protest against police harassment. And that was following a police raid on New Year's Eve in 1969, where a dozen gay men were charged with the crime of kissing at midnight. So that was the beginnings of the gay movement in California and in America, really. And LA was also the place where the largest gay newspaper was published, The Advocate, which today is the largest gay publication in the world. LA became the center of the largest gay church in the world. The Metropolitan Community Church exists everywhere in America. So LA kind of pioneered gays going public and challenging the police and establishing a presence with their own media, their own institutions, and their own public space. The colleges, yes, you and I think Harvard, Columbia,
Berkeley,
Berkeley, it may be Michigan or Wisconsin, the big place, either the Ivy League or the big public universities were the center of anti-war activism. Not in Los Angeles. As you said, we tell the story of Valley State, which had the largest mass arrest on any campus in Southern California, second only to, I think, San Francisco State. Valley State started out as a strong SDS chapter that was organizing against the war, but on Election Day in 1968, the Black Students Union occupied the president's office in the administration building. They had not been planning on doing this for a year, like you and I had been in Cambridge the next year. It was sort of a spur of the moment thing where there had been a racist incident involving the football coaches, and they went to the head of the athletic department and demanded that the racist coach be fired, and this guy told them, well, the only person who can fire the coach is the president. And they said, well, let's go ask the president. So they all marched over to the president's office and decided to occupy the building and then decided to demand a Black Studies program, which had been talked about a great deal and nothing had happened with. And by the end of the day, the president had agreed to their demands. But then the next day, they were all arrested and charged with 1,730 felonies of kidnapping because they'd held hostages. It was the largest felony trial in the history of the New Left. No campus in anywhere in America had as many felony charges as what is now Cal State Northridge and was then Valley State. This is mostly the work of the DA Evel Younger, who went on to become a more prominent political figure. And then the campus was embroiled for the next year in the felony trials of 20, I think in the end there were about 22 black students charged with 1,730 felonies. In the end, several served months in jail. The most important leaders were banned from campus forever. And the story of Valley State is a crucial example. This was a campus kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Northridge in 1968 was like out in the
orange
bean fields.
Groves, right? Yeah.
Orange groves. Yes, you're right. Correction. I stand corrected. The orange groves. You know, it was the last place you would expect a Berkeley or San Francisco State type explosion to occur, but it just showed how there were radical students everywhere and how there was black studies everywhere. And actually, the biggest success story from Valley State was the establishment of a Chicano studies program. Mm-hmm. The Chicano students had not participated in this sit-in because they weren't part of this football protest. So they were still allowed on campus. Valley State created a Chicano studies program that became kind of the trendsetter, the pace setter, the intellectual center of Chicano studies for everywhere in the United States, and still is one of the largest and most successful programs. And that was under the leadership of Rudy Acuna, who was quite a brilliant politician, a campus politician, as well as a great scholar of what Chicano studies could be. So black studies, there is a African American studies program at Cal State Northridge now. That's the Chicano studies program there.
Yeah. And the last thing, I want to shift to that question that I raised at the start of what I was talking about is 60s 2.0 for the rest of this conversation,
yeah.
Like where we stand. But the last thing I want to mention is that the other piece is that a lot of the activism came from high school here. We don't have time to talk about it, but the Chicano moratorium, the Chicano walkout, this was amazing that this was bubbling up from, as I say, high schools and even younger. So let's shift to this thing that I mentioned at the top, which is that I said I've been thinking about something I call 60s 2.0, and I'm not the first to notice young people today share many of the values of young people of the 60s. And I say, I always say the best of the 60s. There were excesses, there was darkness, there was foolishness, but there were also, as we've talked about, real substantial calls for change in society, socially, politically, economically, racially. And I'm interested in whether a few things that I see might improve their chances of building something sustainable. First, the technology that makes it easier to actually reduce material consumption, which is one of the sort of things that the 60s talked about and the current values talk about. We don't need to just be consumers. Well, technology makes that a little easier now. Also, the ability to interact with diverse others, unbound by geography. And then the technology that allows you, where it took 4 months to organize the Vietnam moratorium, it took hours to organize the protests against the travel bans at the start of the Trump campaign. Second, the talent pool is so much bigger. Almost all the leadership in the 60s was male. White organizations were usually led by white males, black, Latino, et cetera, et cetera. And now you see male, female, all sorts of, you know, gender choices, the races. I always say two words, Greta Thunberg. I mean, in other words, an obscure teenager from Scandinavia is a world leader. And so there is just so much more talent and creativity to draw on. And third, that my joke is that for us, there were 100 beatniks in San Francisco and 100 in Greenwich Village. And other than that, we were on our own. Whereas now there are folks in our generation and the generations in between that support young people. I saw all this, you know, as I looked last in 2019, where there were mass demonstrations all over the world, and then it all stops with the pandemic. But then following George Floyd's murder, it is reborn, you know, and you look and you see a range of ages. a range of color, et cetera, in the demonstrations that followed. Your thoughts about whether such a notion is helpful and what you see?
I think you're absolutely right. What has struck me, thinking along very much the same lines, is how much better the movement that we've seen over the past summer has been than what we, the best of what we were able to do in the 60s. It's so much bigger. The Black Lives Matter has had protests under that rubric in every city and town in America. There's massive support among white people for Black Lives Matter. There was a demonstration with hundreds of people in Newport Beach saying Black Lives Matter. This, of course, is the most Republican, the wealthiest, the most conservative place in Southern California. If there's Black Lives Matter in Newport Beach, things are changing in America. Second of all, they've been much more successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, the city of L.A., the mayor, after 1,000 people demonstrated outside his house and tens of thousands in the streets, announced that instead of increasing the budget of the LAPD by 6%, which had been his plan, he would cut it by $150 or $200 million. Cutting the budget of the LAPD was inconceivable just 6 months ago.
Right.
Of course, it's not enough. Of course, we want a lot more. But this is a measure of success that was unimaginable to us. Partly, why is this possible to have such a successful protest movement? It's for the many things that you pointed out. I would underline one of them especially. You know, if you look at what damaged our movement aside from the FBI, COINTELPRO, right. Aside from the police harassment. One of the biggest problems was internecine feuding, splits, you know, SDS, you may remember.
Oh, my gosh.
Bitterly split in 1969. Yep. You know, each side expelled the other side from the organization. The same thing happened in the Black movement. Intense, actually murderous rivalries between the Panthers and Ron Karenga's US organization. US members killed two Black Panthers at UCLA in 1969. We haven't seen anything like that kind of factionalism, rivalry, internecine sniping in Black Lives Matter. Why is that? I asked Melina Abdullah, why is that? And she said, you know, I think the fact that this movement is led by women has something to do with that.
That was the underlying cause.
And they've been around for a long time. You know, Black Lives Matter is now, I think, 7 years old.
Yeah.
And so they've had a lot of experience. They know what they're doing. I mean, you know, the SDS of our era, there was a whole new crop of even more radical leaders every 9 months.
Right.
So I think the fact that it's a women-led movement with a lot of experience, very principled, very radical, very uncompromising, but they also believe in politics. You know, politics and protest. We want to elect a new district attorney, they say. You know, vote for George Gascon. But they don't say stop protesting because it will interfere with, you know, political. The electoral campaign. They know how to combine electoral politics and protest in the streets. They know how to avoid public displays of rivalries, bitterness, internecine harassment, and because of the technology that you've cited, that cell phone video, which we didn't have, they've been able to document what's been going on, and so they are way ahead, miles better than anything we were able to accomplish. That's what it seems to me like at this point.
Right, and that's the Black Lives Matter. You look other places, it's Extinction Rebellion, you know. I'm talking about other issues as well.
Yes.
Extinction
yes.
Rebellion over in Europe, but it's on climate and the size of climate demonstration. The intersectionality, which you point out was a feature, I think, of Los Angeles in the 60s. The word hadn't been coined yet, I don't assume. But
right.
But to me, it seems like it's working on all these different fronts. I'm hopeful. And you say, there's a wonderful line that you say, this book was written, I put the paper down that I had written it on, but you say, yes, to keep that circle unbroken, this book was written. And in that, that's one of the last lines of your book, to say that the young people that, and of course you had to get the book to publication before Black Lives Matter happened, but that you wrote the book and charted the history to keep the circle unbroken between the 60s and the current moment.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. The book is Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. You can learn more at johnweiner.com. That's J-O-N-W-I-E-N-E-R.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. That's TERRENCEMCNALLY.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and at other podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at Apple Podcasts and the other ones. Thanks to G and to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices for production. And most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, John Wiener. Keep up your good work.
Total pleasure. Thank you.